Hello, everybody. I want to welcome you all to Comic-Con. This is a real pleasure for me. I want to introduce you to Robert Williams. I don't think I need to give you much of an introduction to Robert, so I'll be really brief if by any chance any of you do need an introduction. I would say Robert's pretty humble, so he might push back, but I would say Robert is probably the greatest living painter in America. I told you.
I gotta keep a straight face.
You don't have to. But I really do mean that. And, you know, he's had an incredibly storied career that has, you know, shifted through a lot of scenes, a lot of movements. And he's practically the father of an entire movement in the art world on the West Coast, if not the entire country. The main reason he's here, I suppose, is due to his roots in the comics, both as one of founding member of the Zap Collective, along with Robert Crumb, Victor Moscoso, Spain Rodriguez, and S. Clay Wilson. And since then has gone on to mostly eschew the comics world for more of the fine art world, but the way that they integrate together, I think, is still relevant to what's going on at this show. I want to leave as much time for questions as we can, because we have a pretty short period of time, and I'm sure if you're all here, it's because you're all fans, and I want to give you the opportunity to ask Robert anything you might have to ask. I was thinking about this panel the last couple of days, and I wanted to start by asking you a question about your process that I was kind of surprised I didn't already know the answer to, because I've known you for 20 years. And that is, when you conceive of a painting, how much of the painting manifests in the actual drawing or sketching of an idea, and or how much of it is it that you have a fairly realized idea in your head that you're just trying to get down on paper or canvas?
Well, a young art student or a young kid who does a piece of artwork, his ability to realize what his idea was like maybe 15 or 20%. Mm-hmm. A kid in junior high school who does a piece of artwork that thinks he's an artist, and he does a piece of artwork, well, what's originally in his mind and what gets done is like maybe 35-40%. And you get into college, maybe it's 50%. You know, you're a young person going to art school and college, and he sits down to do a project, he or her sit down to do a project, and that thing turns out to be maybe 50 or 60% of what was actually in their head. But by the time they're in college, they don't tell people that they've learned enough to not tell people that this wasn't just their original concept. So, I've been oil painting since 1957, so I can do it about 85%. I can sit down, I can have an idea in my head, and then when it gets finished on the canvas, this is about 85% of what I started out with. Now, there's always changes. How I come to the ideas is a whole different ballgame. Now, my first philosophy or virtue is never copy anybody else. The second one is never do anything I've ever done before and do something that's never been seen. See? So the big problem there is I've limited my audience to people that have to deal with the whole image they're not familiar with. Now, see, if I was a pop artist, I would be dealing with things that everybody knew, so I'd be really safe. But when you get out there in that lone forest of imagination, you're kind of on your own, and you do something and show it to people, and They won't know what to make of it. They just maybe it's poetic enough that they'll see some virtuosity in it. So I've really impacted myself not being a pop artist. You know, if I just copied other people or if I copied things around me, that'd be really safe because all the promotion and visual familiarity had already been established. But I'm in that scratchy area.
Have you had those rules in place for longer than you can think? Or?
Well, yeah. Kind of saw it was kind of pathetic to copy stuff.
Yeah, sure. But that's interesting too, because a lot of the kind of what I consider the kind of left coast pop surrealism that I think you've definitely influenced, they've kind of gone, taken it in a little different direction where I think a lot of it is pop art. And do you think that's just because of a lack of a visual imagination?
Well, I don't want to be critical of people, you know.
Fair enough.
You know, there's no bad or good or anything about art. It's just you know, it's just what you do. There's no real law. And there's entire academic cultures that try to set up regulations. But you know, that's like trying to apprehend a fart in a dream catcher.
Well, I'm interested in this idea of, like, you know, you say you want to do something that's never been seen before. And that relates to the first question I asked you, where when you conceive of an idea for a painting, can you visualize it in your head, or is it more the concept that you have an idea of that you're just executing visually?
Well, let me try to get to your answer here. When I was very, very young, I was a comic book reader. That's why I'm sitting up here. And in the late 40s and early 50s, there was like some really great comics. And they got run out of business and whatnot. But I still remember the really lurid, adventurous comic books that stimulated me as a child. So when I got older and I wanted to be an artist and go to art school, I had these ideas. You know, I was already polluted with pulp magazine covers and B-movie posters and hot rod art and girly magazines and comic books, you know, and I thought, well, I'm going to... I developed a certain skill at draftsmanship, and I thought, well, man, I've got enough craftsmanship, man, I'm going to really knock them out in school, man. But the problem was I was born at the wrong time. And I started going to art school right in the middle of abstract expressionism. So it was like really detrimental to be arrogant enough to show craftsmanship. See, craftsmanship was considered on the same level as someone doing something at a sewing bee for the fair or something. You know, it's like, after World War II, New York became the center of the art world. And there's two New York art critics, Clement Greenberg and Harold Rosenberg, that established abstract expressionism, which just murdered realism. And it also murdered surrealism. But I didn't know that until I got older and started going to art school. But I was, you know, the other art students were referred to me in a really demeaning terms, the illustrator. You're the illustrator. You know, you shouldn't really try to be in fine arts. You should take a commercial job or be an illustrator. So I thought, well, no, I hate commercial art. I tried commercial art, and I'm not the kind of guy that's going to submit sketches to an art director and haggle over this and that. I got too many mental problems to try to be a successful commercial artist. And I got my imagination is like a runaway mare. You know, it's like my imagination is like trying to put a gorilla in a birdcage. It just can't be done. So I made straight A's in art school, but you know, I wasn't fitting in with my peer group, and I went to Los Angeles City College, and I was the college newspaper cartoonist and got national awards. I was just like this, you know, this kind of outside guy, and I was destined. You know, I just said, well, I'm going to have to be a painter. if I have to face everybody, I'll face everybody with realism. So I went from job to job and getting this job and getting fired and that job and getting fired. And so finally I got a job with Ed Big Daddy Roth, the custom car builder, who was really hungry for wild imagination, and I kind of like really filled that bill. So I lived in this bohemian world of Ed Roth, and this was like right when the Vietnam War started. And I'd already parceled the drug culture, and I picked up being in the drug culture from working in Carnival in the late 50s and early 60s. So I was like an uncontrollable bohemian to begin with. And so I started working for Roth, and all of a sudden I was making an awful lot of money, and I was still doing oil paintings. I couldn't show them any gallery. I couldn't show them any museum. No book would publish them, no magazine. So Roth went out of business, and by that time I tied up with Robert Crumb and Gilbert Shelton and got into Zap Comics, and Zap Comics was right up my alley, man, because you could get wilder, more brutal than Zap Comics, and so that was a wonderful experience for me. So that was working for Roth and being in Zap Comics was a real fortunate situation. Then I met a couple of millionaires who were really interested in the work because of the craftsmanship and imagination, so you know, lonely me was making like a lot of good money, see? And of course I've always loved comics and whatnot, and then the thing with the comics, as a young kid I saw EC Comics go out of business, be run out of business by Senate investigations in 54 caused by that book, Innocent, Seduction of the Innocents. All of a sudden, one day you got really great comics, and the next day you got like little happy animal comics and goofy comic books, you know. So, man, that became like a wasteland, and I always kind of had a resentment about that. And that's one thing about Zap Comics is it was kind of like a revenge factor on culture, you know. If you thought those comic books were bad back in 1953, pal, you ain't seen nothing yet. You know? Like no holes barred. So anyway, I did well with Zap Comics and other underground comics. And but meantime, I was still painting. And it's like I didn't have a peer group. It's like everyone I knew is either a pop artist or an abstract expressionist or a postmodernist. It's like the entire art community, the entire academic art world was in cahoots that you had to do stuff sloppy. It was like you just had to do stuff sloppy. So anyway, I got involved with punk rockers, and the punk rockers were not really skilled, but they were free thinkers, and they had these art shows in L.A., started in New York, with these after-hours clubs, where the after-hours clubs were just like a ruse to sell liquor without a license. All these drunken, loaded kids would get out of these clubs, and then they go to these after-hours clubs and have these bogus art shows. I mean, man, this is a wonderful opportunity. So, I mean, I could draw a little bit, man, so I just did enormous. Since I was in Zap, I understood the power and the energy of gratuitous sex and violence. So I did these really goofy paintings, you know. I don't know how you describe how off the wall this stuff was, but it was lurid. It couldn't be lurid enough. And I mean, in my audience is like young people that are coming there loaded, that are peeing and puking on the art and falling down. And so, I mean, it wasn't like an intellectual audience, but man, it was like I couldn't have found a more faithful following. So I couldn't paint these paintings fast enough. So as I painted them, I slowly started tightening them up and slowly started putting backgrounds in. You know? And once I established myself with a peer group, like Gary Panter, a few of these other people, George Ann Dean, these other pretty well-known punk rock artists, once I established myself and I had a peer group, say, to lean against, then I could start just getting wilder and wilder. So I start all of a sudden on these things. I'm starting to license these things out to album covers, to rock bands and stuff. So then my popularity got really big. I started getting write-ups in tattoo magazines and music magazines, and you know. And the poor real art world was still in this rut that they'd carved for themselves. You know, this unimaginative thing. You know? So I was like really doing good. My audience was like really getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I would want to point out one thing. All the artists in Zap Comics and most of the underground artists all had at one time or another a formal academic art background and faced the same situation with me, that they were just at the wrong period of time in history. That they wanted to narratively express themselves, and just three dabs on canvas just wasn't going to do it. So anyway, my life started getting sweeter and sweeter, and I went from funky galleries to better galleries to better galleries. I got Tony Schifrazzi, one of the biggest galleries in the world in New York, and now my fanny's sitting in front of you.
So you say you were born at the wrong time, and maybe the Zap guys are born at the wrong time, but you guys made it the right time for you by doing your own thing.
We're still scratching, you know. I'm so grateful that these people showed up for me to even talk to. It was not a simple matter to get these people here.
Yeah. So you're born at the right time, but you're also clearly a product of your time, is what I'm trying to say, in terms of you were both informed by the things that you liked and the things that you existed in opposition to the things that you didn't like.
Well, soon I needed a peer group and a PowerPoint so bad that I started a magazine called Juxtapose.
Right.
So I got all the friends that I knew were artists who did this magazine. So I got Thrasher Magazine, the publishing company in San Francisco, to do Juxtapose Magazine. And Juxtapose Magazine started out in 1994, and the first print run was 23,000. It was kind of a test run. And it had national distribution. And it sold extremely well, the first issue. And then the second issue came out, the third issue, and they were just selling incredibly well. And the print run was going up and up and up. And it was like, obviously, there's a need for this kind of art magazine, you know, because you get a regular art magazine, man, and you're just dying of boredom, you know. You got little bitty pictures, big work, technical write-ups, and it's just not very interesting magazines. But Juxtapose really hit a sweet spot, man, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then all of a sudden, it started outselling Art Forum. And wow. But the art schools wouldn't let it, the art classes wouldn't let the magazine into class, see. Then all of a sudden, it outsold Art in America. That was the second biggest. And then eventually, it outsold Art News, which is the biggest art magazine in the world. And the little shitty little magazine we started all of a sudden become like the largest selling art magazine in the world. So then we realized that maybe we could go walk up to the fortress door of the academia and knock on their portcullis and say, let us in. You know? But then, like anything comes along, I remember the underground comics, there was like, you had like these real raw, gnarly, original underground comics, and then everyone jumped on the bandwagon and started diluting out with softer material. And then, the same thing started happening. The same thing started happening with the art. My first book was in 79, called The Lowbrow Art of Robert Williams. The publishing company says, well, we sell underground comics, but we'll do an art magazine, an art book for you, but it's got to be half underground comics, because that's the only way to sell it. So it sold really well, and that's where the name Lowbrow Art started, see. Now, that's kind of a funky, goofy name, but what it alluded to was, we're the bottom of the barrel, and there's only one way up, you know, there's one way to go, and that'd be up, and then the cream always comes to the top. Well, everyone else started jumping on the bandwagon, and lowbrow, I don't like lowbrow, so they come up with this term, pop surrealism, and that was a term that come from Kenny Scharf when he had a show at the Salvador Dali Museum. And then they had another show somewhere else. And all the people that now call themselves pop surrealists were actually had nothing to do with the original early shows of pop surrealism. So it's kind of like the kind of a meaningless, sweet name trying to hide under two different wings. Like pop art's about appropriation. Surrealism, if you weren't around in 1924 to be a surrealist, you weren't a surrealist. That was just the way it was. The surrealist movement was a tight movement to be in. They didn't let anybody in, and they kicked a lot of people out, including Salvador Dali. So calling yourself a surrealist is You know, it's just like patting yourself on the back and kidding yourself. So there's a lot, like a lot of these artists like to call themselves pop surrealists, but you know, you kind of own your own. In reality, what it is feral artists. We're all feral artists. We kind of come out of the wilderness, you know. And it's not like I got a real good academic background in history of art. I ain't sitting and gnaw the bone where anybody here has got an art background. You know, I know the difference in Manet and Monet and Pizarro and Picasso and whoever you want to talk about when they were born and what they did. You know, I'm not a goofball completely, but I like to think, you know, lowbrow is it kind of explained it, you know. But nonetheless, I run aground here.
So where do you think we're at today? I mean, you coming from let me rephrase that. The Zapp seemed very much an FU to the world.
Zapp?
Yeah.
No. Well, no. Zapp was not made for the general public. People don't know this about underground comics. Zapp Comics, the first comic, was made for an arcane group of people that resisted society, that had abstract imaginations. See? It wasn't a big thing to call in the herd. It wasn't like trying to be the shepherd. It was like, man, it was just like flipped out imagination, wild narrative, you know, for a special group of people that this would appeal to, you know. Then later, when they come on, everyone had to make a living, so they, you know, got a little more sociable with the material.
But I guess what I was getting at is like something like, okay, let's take a comic like Felch, which was a very controversial comic.
Which one?
Felch.
Felch.
Felch was an underground comic.
You better let me describe Felch. Okay, I'm going to describe this comic book. I was giving a lecture in Gainesville, Florida to a big crowd and had to explain Felch to them. Felch was an outlaw comic book that was extremely pornographic, and it described a sexual act. It was supposed to be one of the worst ever. And here's a way to describe it. It's withdrawing the semen out of someone's lower digestive tract. See? So, and I guess ingesting it. So,
who had the idea of Felch?
Okay.
Who said we need to make a comic?
In 69, we were all partying at Christmas up at Robert Crumb's place in Potter Valley. We're having a wild Zapp party up there. And S. Clay Wilson said he was talking to Ken Weaver of the Fugs. And he said, Ken Weaver, come across this real old word called Felch and Felching. And he described it to me. And I said, man, that's our next comic. I'll edit it. So I gave it to everybody. We all put a couple of pages in Felch. Okay, since we've done that part, I'm going to tell you a little Felch story. George DiCaprio, Leonardo DiCaprio's dad, used to be the distributor for Underground Comics in Southern California. Okay. So the police were really serious on busting Underground Comics. So George DiCaprio had all these different shops and customers that he went around and serviced and distributed comics to. So all of a sudden, the police came in and busted a couple of these venues, bookstores and whatnot, psychedelic head shops and whatnot. So all of a sudden, poor George can't sell any underground comics. So the cops got all these underground comics and they put them in a box. And then George was called he got a lawyer, and he was with the lawyer of one of the bookstore owners, and they were outside the judge's office for a hearing, see. So inside, they left the door open, and the prosecuting attorney is in with the judge in his office, and they got the big box of dirty comics there, the underground comics. And apparently, the cops had been going through this box and they found that little Felch. They said, well, whoa, nobody will miss this. So they based the whole case on that Felch. So George and the attorney and the bookstore owner sitting out in the lobby of the judge's office, And the prosecuting attorney and the judges in there yelling, "Where's the felch? Where's the felch?" And they couldn't find the felch, so the whole thing fell through.
So we live in quite a different world, I think, in those times.
We do. We live in a very complacent time now compared to when underground comics started.
And I feel like, you know, you might be run out of town if you came out with a felch today.
No, but we're on the brink of that.
Yeah.
We're on the brink of repression. And I hate to say this, but probably the guy that can do us the most good is that goddamn Donald Trump. Because he would have energized the new generation has been so complacent, so just taking everything for granted, you know, that they don't realize with Zap Comics, around 400 people went to jail selling Zap Comics, you know, and their sacrifice eventually made it, and that's just Zap, not the rest of
right.
it, you know, a lot of people went to jail, and their sacrifice made it possible so you can see a dirty funny book, you know.
Do you feel like you feel like we've regressed in?
Yeah, I think Donald Trump is going to create a rough situation and swing into the right, and the young people are all of a sudden going to find out they don't have these freedoms that they took for granted the last 40 years, and there should be a resurgence and a liberal underground.
I'm curious to know if you... Were you aware of the Harry Who at the time in the 60s?
Yes.
Did you ever cross paths with them?
No.
No?
No.
Did you see them as kind of kindred spirits, or were they...
Well, you know, I wondered if the underground comics would have something to do with their world, too.
Well, I think it did, right?
Yeah. Well, listen. One of the most important people in the art world, period, and one of the most famous... was Walter Hobbs. And Walter Hobbs made the top artist on the West Coast. Walter Hobbs gave Andy Warhol his first show. Andy Warhol brought Marcel Duchamp to the United States for the first time since the 30s and got him a show. I can't talk about how wonderful Walter Hobbs was. And I never get along with academics in the art world, but I met Walter Hobbs. Walter Hobbs had a Zap comic book show at the Corcoran Museum in Washington, D.C. in 71. Do you know how off the wall and daring that is? I mean, whoa, a Zap show in Washington, D.C.? I mean, and this is the top art guy in the world, so I had to be very close friends with Walter Hobbs, you know, and he would tell me all the dirt on the art world and how fucked up it was and how it had a fortress mentality to take care of itself. This is the very top guy. When Walter Hobbs died, he was in charge of the Monell Collection in Houston, and he was one of the primary curators and directors at the Guggenheim. And when he died, he was designated in the United States and Europe as the number one museum curator, period. See? So anyway, that was my good buddy that liked Zap Comics. So that was a crack in the dam, you know. But he died, and so...
He wrote the introduction to Malicious Resplendence,
one of
your books. You mentioned the lowbrow art book, and that book's fascinating to me because it's a collection of your paintings as well as some of the underground stuff, but most if not all of the paintings are in black and white in that first lowbrow book, right?
Well, there's a color, too.
There was a signature.
Two color signatures, yeah. Well, then they had no budget. There were no art books like that.
I know, there weren't. But
and I had a distributor through Underground Comic Grapevines. That's the only way I could move those books.
It must have been so frustrating, though, to have these giant canvases printed in black and white.
Well, getting them out there at all was a miracle. You know, have your whole book is just your crazy stuff back then. You know, it was just a wonderful experience.
Yeah. So do you think that what you're talking about, you know, we're swinging to the right as a country, and that could create a groundswell of great art?
That's all good that ever could come of it.
Do you think that one of the things I keep coming back to Felch, not because I think it's this, you know, great curiosity or anything, I mean, it's a great comic book, it really is,
but I don't bring sexually aroused at those silly ass comic books.
No. Yeah, and that's the reason that they—that's the reason that you guys weren't prosecuted.
About 1972, most of the underground artists got a swelled head, thought they were going to go to New York and take over underground comics. They all moved to New York, and the mafia run everybody out. They thought these comics were pornography.
Well, and that's why they ultimately mostly survived obscenity challenges, because part of the law of obscenity is that the work must appeal to the purient interest, and sexually aroused in some way. And that was I don't think that was ever really your intent.
The underground comics were coinciding with the pornography industry too. You know, you're starting to see about 1969, 1970. You're starting to see total nudity and sex acts. And, I don't want to go into descriptions, but all kind of stuff. Now, what was a real influence on the underground artists was back in the 20s and 30s with those 8-page Bibles, those Tijuana Bibles. Oh, man, when I was 9 years old and saw one of those, man, my life looked like it was worth living. You know?
Is anybody not familiar with the Tijuana Bibles? So we don't have to explain them. Tijuana Bibles were basically bootleg comics about cartoon characters of the era.
Movie stars,
cartoon characters, movie characters, and they would make sex comics. Really, really low rent, kind of amateurish, satirical porno comics of them, basically.
Very much part of American culture.
And they're very much, part of the continuum of underground comics.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. And EC comics and up through today. Do you think there's a place for that kind of art today? Or have we...
Well, I do.
Or have we transcended the need for it?
I do. I think the right wing in this country is trying to get rid of that completely, trying to revert back to the 50s. But sure, I mean, if you like that kind of garbage, I think you should be able to get it.
I'll buy that.
I mean, when you do something that's prurient or sexual, you have to realize, well, this is going to bug a lot of people, and some people are going to get sexually excited. But
that was never really, I don't think that was really your intent, was it?
No, I wasn't. Women are beautiful. I like drawing naked ladies. It was just a pleasure to do that.
I'm happy to open up the field to questions at any point, or we can keep talking.
Can I ask you a question? I'm not familiar with your work as I should be. I know I've met you before and I've talked to you a couple times, but have you ever thought, and you probably have thought of this, it's just a question, have you ever thought of doing a continuing character or a character that you...
I do have one called Coochie Cootie.
Yeah, Coochie Cootie.
Yeah, you have to hunt that up. It came out in 69, is that coming? Yeah. It was kind of like Mickey Mouse with some real problems. Mickey Mouse had this punk rock girlfriend that screwed everybody with him. He had to deal with this all the time.
It's like some X-rated version of if Iwerks had stayed at Disney and become an underground artist, you might have come up with Coochie Cootie.
Well, Ewerks had Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse kissing and stuff, making heavy smack to mouth and stuff. And if he would have stayed with Disney, Disney would have been completely different today.
If you were born in 1990 and were a 25-year-old today, how do you think, the world would inform you and alter you.
If I was in 1990, I'd be out here in the lobby, out here with a superhero costume.
Well, there you go. You weren't born at the wrong time. You were born at the right time. Does anybody else have any questions? Yeah.
The juxtaposis has changed everything.
It has?
It's changed everything.
Yeah, it has. It's in every art school now.
I teach. The outlook, the art world responds differently. You took the ship and you pointed it in a different direction.
Well, I appreciate what you say.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, years ago, you had a show on La Cienega, and it was south of Pico. Site for destruction. You had all your big major paintings there.
That was 1980.
That was 1980.
How do you remember that?
I was there. You gave me a card. It said, it had a bust of you with a little olive leaf, and it said, better to sever my hand than create some unartly thing. And I still have it. I still have it. And this is my question. You pushed a lot of buttons, and you held true to you. You started this magazine, and now the ship's going a different direction.
God, you're going to be blushing at both ends.
What do you think? I mean, you got back at all those abstract expressionists, and you won.
Well, I face those guys all the time. You know, I'm very good friends with the artists that Walter Hobbs created, Ed Ruscha and Billy Al Banks, and all those big blue chip artists, you know, and those are the people that got me into Tony Schiaparazzi Gallery. But I had to assure them that I represent an art movement that offers them no threat. If what I do, and if I have a large following, they will always be honored for their contributions to the art, and they'll always have the upper hand academically. That I represent this lower phylum of imagination that's going wild. And I get a lot of appreciation from those people.
Well, so. They should surrender to you. Why do they have to offer you...
Because that's like trying to capture a fart in a dream catcher, man. There's no rules on this thing. You know, this isn't about belief systems.
But the thing is you gave permission to a lot of kids and young people to express themselves in ways that are not sanctioned by the wider fine art market and all that stuff.
Well, you know, four or five people have got read Juxtapose, started Juxtapose, are multimillionaires now. Mm-hmm. Way past me. Big blue chip artists now that make a lot of money. So... the cancer's out there.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Robert, what kind of works are you producing now, and what do you hope to or plan on producing in the next couple of years?
Have you ever seen my work?
Yeah.
It's just an extension of that. I paint every day. Look at my website. Yes?
When was the first time you found the Tijuana Comics?
Like 8 or 9 in South Alabama, someone's found it on their dad's night table or something. Whoa, Nelly. Then I saw the mechanics of the possibilities here.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have a few more questions.
If no one has seen Mr. Bitchin documentary, I highly recommend that. I thank you for letting us showing it in Iowa. Huge response there.
Thank you.
I want to know, when you had that middle section of the 80s, it seemed like you had some home movies that were put into that documentary. Were you already planning on doing a documentary on yourself back then? Or?
That movie that you're talking about, Mr. Bitchin, took 20 years to make and went through 3 film companies. So what you're looking at is just a whole bunch of series of whole stuff. You know. So
you did have the concept many years ago that you wanted to have this lifelong project on film?
No, not at all. Not at all.
But he's talking about there were home movies in the
yeah,
film.
There were all kinds of stuff that was documented, punk rock clubs and whatnot.
I just didn't know if you personally or if you got that footage from other people or how that all came about.
Well, people saw money in it and kept it going. It almost ruined me and my wife Suzanne's life to have people around us continually filming us. It was just horrible.
Right.
And I can't watch the thing. I mean, how many times can I look at myself? Oh, look at this idiot. You know? But yes.
Well, I've been a fan since buying Zap Comics in Hollywood Boulevard in the 70s, and I just want to say how glad I am that your genius is now recognized.
Thank you. I appreciate it. You're very kind. Very kind. You test my humility.
A lot of people don't know it, but you did the same thing for the hot dog world as you did for art. You were the first guy out there with a dirty-ass car.
First guy started Rat Rods.
You threatened that community in the same way that you threaten the fire. How's that work?
Well, there's a big Juxtapose show coming to the Peterson Museum in September. And August 11th, I've got to give a lecture and a presentation at the NHRA Museum in Pomona. They'll have my cars there. The Juxtapose show at the Peterson Museum is going to have about 50 artists, and it's going to be a big to-do.
But you pushed their buttons, too. They were
how can I pull all this together, you know? I'm already infringing in a comic book world here with underground painting.
That's all.
So it's a miracle as many people showed up. Yes.
So Coochie Cootie's a continuing character, so do you have plans on continuing it?
Well, I put it in paintings and whatnot, and drawings ever so often.
Do you find did you find right from the start the paintings as narratively satisfying as comics?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And when I started doing comic books, I learned timing, and I learned how to apply that to paintings. I learned how to deal in the fourth dimension. Fourth dimension's time and movement. And that's a comic book has movement and time in it, and I learned how to apply that into paintings. Not only just have something done real, but have something going on where there's an exchange with two people or a crowd or something moving.
Yeah, your paintings read in a way that a lot of paintings don't.
Yes?
I saw a show of yours. I think it was at the Mocha in L.A. And it was a big show.
Yeah. Helter Skelter.
Was it Helter Skelter? But I thought you had a solo. Anyway, my question, when I was looking at the paintings, the imagery is like really intense and amazing and big. The scale is quite large, right?
They picketed me, you know. I got picketed to that show. They said they'd never show me again at Mocha.
What I remember is the brushstrokes themselves are actually really modest and pretty consistent across the surface. And I wonder, I was thinking about, you talked about like pop art and the notion of reproduction in your work. It seems like the reproduction is really where the scale gets all of a sudden small again. And I wonder, we talked about craft and we also talk a lot about commercial work. Like starting in some ways, people say you should go towards commercial work. And my question is something like, how do you feel about when a large-scale reading that you do gets reduced to, even though the books are quite lush and big, it's quite a reduction. What's your sense of that as an artist? Do you think of yourself as making work for reproduction?
Well, both. There's nothing nicer than a big, large oil painting, but you got to get people to see it. And it's very difficult to get museum shows. In fact, I've been extremely lucky in the last four or five years. I've had 6 museum shows in a row. I'm going on to my 7th. But those are very hard to come by. And to have the thing in front of people any way I can on film or a book, that's the important thing, to people see it.
So is that something you're aware of when you're making those large-scale paintings?
Well, let me tell you what I'm aware of on those big paintings. The suckers are time-consuming, and I'm only one person. You see these big paintings these other people do, they have crews.
Yeah.
I'm a one-guy character here, you know. You see all these big paintings. You know, Salvador Dali had 6 people working for him. You wonder, how can he spend half the year at the St. Regency in New York and do all that work? Well, he didn't do it. Well, another element you got to realize when you paint something big is you got to sell the goddamn thing. So I got to realize what my market is on something like that. If I do this big giant thing and ask a fortune for it, I'll be eating that thing. So you know, I had to factor in a lot of things. I love big, wonderful oil paintings. I wish I had 4 lifetimes to carry that out, but it's the way the situation is.
You still working at that scale these days?
Yeah. Yeah, I did big ones and little ones. And
was there like the fourth of the size of this big?
Yeah.
That's fine.
Or half that size.
We're working on, I'm the associate publisher at Fantagraphics Books, and we've published a few of Robert's books, and I should mention that we're working right now on a pretty massive career retrospective of Robert's work that's going to come out next summer in conjunction with a museum show that he's having at the Bellevue Art Museum up in the Pacific Northwest. So I hope you'll all look for it. We probably have time for just 1 or 2 more questions, I think.
Yes.
Do you have any techniques that you use to like conjure your vision for projects when you just start creating and it comes to you?
I didn't get your question.
How do you come up with like your visions for your projects? Like, does it
Well, it's like trying to pass a spike ball. You know, you've got to sit down and come up with the ideas. You know, you've got to sit down by yourself with a pencil and paper and come up with ideas. And they have to be poetic. They have to mean something. So I've got sketches from the past that I look at what I've done. There's a whole different variety of ways I come up with ideas, but the important thing is not to copy other people. So I know I can sit and discuss technique and coming up with ideas with you all day. I hope I just made it simple for you. That's a hard part. You have to, when you do art, to do something original, you know, that's when you're under pressure.
I'm getting the word that we have to wrap up here, so yeah. Sorry, no more questions.
Thanks for coming. I really appreciate it. Robert.